Years ago, when I worked for Global Growers, which is a refugee farming collective in Atlanta, one of my favorite parts was learning about the foods that were important to the various culture groups that we worked with. The women from Burundi grew field corn, peanuts, tomatoes, and a type of amaranth they called mchicha. Our growers from Bhutan grew these tiny chilies that burned my fingers even to touch them. They also had this small, round, light green eggplant that was as hard as a golf ball, and they grew pumpkins to eat the leaves, not the fruit. One grower from Jamaica grew rows and rows and rows of sweet potatoes, but only ate the leaves, not the tubers. Another Southeast Asian group grew something that they called roselle. It is a relative of hibiscus, but instead of using the flower for tea, they ate the leaves, which were actually wonderful, and they had this surprising lemony taste to them. We had a growers' potluck once a month to help foster community among the diverse staff and farmers. One month, while trying to plan the potluck, we realized that it would fall at the intersection of several major religious holidays for almost all of our farmers. It felt impossible to wrap our heads around all of the various fasting days and religious dietary requirements and cultural food preferences. And finally, someone laughed and decided that the only thing we all had in common was okra. Ensuring access and resources to grow the foods that were culturally important to our farmers and their communities was a big part of our mission at Global Growers. Because food is a central part of culture and identity. In fact, we often associate certain foods strongly with certain cultures. But food and the shifting of cuisine through generations is an example of how migration has always been a normal part of human history. For instance, you might associate potatoes with Ireland, but they originally came from South America. And collard greens, of course, are a staple of soul food, but they originated in the Mediterranean. The Africans who were enslaved and brought to North America braided seeds in their hair for things like peanuts and crowder peas, but peanuts originally came to Africa from South America. And that okra that we all had in common was likely first cultivated in Ethiopia. The migration of food and the people who carried those foods and traditions with them has been a part of the human experience since humanity began. From Genesis to Revelation, our Bible is full of stories of people who migrated. Christianity itself began with a small group of Middle Eastern followers, but spread as its followers moved around the world until it became a worldwide religion. Our sitting here today is the result of a complex history of human migration, some of it good, some of it awful. Because sadly, just as long as humans have been moving about, humans have also been fighting over the land and territory and trying to draw lines saying who is in and who is out. And of course, the history of Christianity's spread has often been complicit, if not outright to blame, for great harm in those conflicts. Perhaps that is why our scriptures go to great lengths to remind us of God's command to care for the stranger. Listening to the news right now, and for the last few years, you'd think that the greatest affront to Christianity and to God's own self is the existence of queer and trans folks. But there are only six passages, six, in the whole of the Bible that maybe address homosexuality. In contrast, at least 40 passages in the Hebrew Testament alone explicitly command the people to care for and protect the strangers living in their land. Deuteronomy 10:19, you shall also love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Psalm 146:9, the Holy One watches over the strangers. God upholds the orphan and the widow, but the way of the wicked God brings to ruin. Zechariah 7:9-10, thus says the God of hosts, render true judgment, show kindness and mercy to one another. Do not oppress the widow, the orphan, the immigrant, or the poor. and do not devise evil in your hearts against one another. Isaiah 56, 6 through 8, and the foreigners who join themselves to me, to minister to me, to love the name of the Holy One and to be my servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Acts 10, 34. Then Peter began to speak to them, I truly understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears God and does what is right is acceptable to God. And Romans, contribute to the needs of the saints, extend hospitality to strangers. And Hebrews, let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it. You get the point. I won't quote the whole Bible to you today. God really, really, really wants us to love the stranger among us. Clearly, there were many passages I could have chosen for today, but I chose these verses from Leviticus because it's a book we don't read from often, ever, in our worship. It's a slog, to be sure. Lots of nitty-gritty details that seem irrelevant to our life today. Some of it is even harmful when read without appropriate context. But when we take it as a whole, the intricate detail of the book of Leviticus is a testament to God's desire to be an intimate part of humanity's daily life. The book is mostly a set of laws governing how priests should handle their priestly business. Maybe I should read it more often than y'all. But the chapters 17 to 26 are called the holiness codes, and they shift the focus from priests to everyday life. Moses received this guidance from God as the people were preparing to reach the promised land. From being enslaved in Egypt to wandering through the desert for a generation, they were finally, finally entering a new land and a covenant with God. And these codes taught the people how to imitate God in their day-to-day life, how to embrace and live into their imago Dei, their image of God, how to recognize and honor the Imago Dei in others, even, maybe especially, the strangers among them. The holiness codes are about how to live out our holiness, not for piety's sake, but for the sake of relationship. Relationship with God, relationship with ourselves, and relationship with others. Now, I have to admit that I hesitated to use these verses from Leviticus. Bethany can tell you I actually had something different in there at the beginning of the week, because the preceding chapter has some of the verses that have been used to condemn homosexuality. I'm not going to deconstruct those today. That's not what we're talking about today. But even those verses, when broken down in context, are about honoring the holiness of relationship, just not the way anti-gay folks want you to think. The heart of this text, of these holiness codes, is that when we violate, abuse, or in any way harm our relationship with the land, with creation, with non-human animals, with our neighbor, and with the stranger among us, and even with ourselves, we violate our relationship with God. Jesus even quotes verse 19:18 when asked about the greatest commandment. He says, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And Leviticus makes it explicit that the stranger is our neighbor and asserts that we are to love our immigrant neighbor as we love ourselves. And that means seeing ourselves in the immigrants and seeing them in us, because actually there is no us and them. We are all one. The parable Jesus tells makes this even clearer. Laying aside my beef with Jesus about demonizing poor goats like that. For those of you who don't know, I raise goats, so I got a problem with that. But this parable is one that is deeply important about what it means to be a Christian. The king in the parable doesn't ask the sheep or goats what they believe, or how they come to worship, or how often they come, whether they are baptized, or even what their prayer life is like. He simply wants to know, have they cared for the vulnerable or not? Because caring for the vulnerable is central to what it means to be a follower of Christ. But if we think this parable is only about caring for the vulnerable, or more specific, only about our acts of charity, then we still miss the point. Because in that interpretation, those with privilege maintain their power while earning some heavenly brownie points. The givers get to be the heroes and the center of the story, while the marginalized continue to be marginalized. But this parable is not only about how we are to behave, but also Jesus revealing something about who he is and who God is. That is, God is not only shows preference for the poor and the immigrant, but God is the poor, the hungry, the sick person, the thirsty, the prisoner, the one who is naked, and God is the immigrant. When read that way, this parable radically changes who is at the center. It is no longer about how we can become sheep, but how God already is among the poor and the immigrants. And in order to find God, we too must locate ourselves among them. Bethany introduced me this week to the work of Miguel de la Torre. In his book called Decolonizing Christianity, Becoming Badass Believers, I don't know about you, but I would like to be a badass believer, so I'm going to read the whole book. He criticizes America's Christianity and its historic complicity in white supremacy. And he outlines the ways that Christian nationalism has harmed the Latinx community. De La Torre writes that he is tired of trying to educate white Christians on how to untangle themselves from Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism. The answer, he says, it's not complicated. It has been in our scriptures all along, in this specific parable. But white Christians have far too often sided with the goats, through the political policies they embrace, and by voting for politicians who refuse to support or even acknowledge the least of these. The Christianity most of us grew up with is a Christianity steeped in white supremacy. It is a Christianity that sees white people on both sides. It is a Christianity that has no problem with dehumanizing, criminalizing, and disappearing immigrants in the name of border security and law and order. It is a Christianity that hails Trump as a protector and defender of the faith, despite all evidence to the contrary, which is to say, it is a Christianity that is unrecognizable from the gospel that Jesus proclaims and the faith he asks of us, his followers. Because if we take Jesus' words in this parable seriously, anytime we do not care for even one, of the least of these, we do not care for him. If each of us, each individual, bears the image of God, and I believe that we do, then God does not just side with the immigrant, God is the immigrant. De La Torre says that we must reject the white God we've been following, and instead bend our knees to the black God, to the Asian American God, to the queer God, to the immigrant God, and then conform ourselves to the face of those who live in oppression. Now Jesus tells this parable after he has ridden into Jerusalem for the Passover, after he has flipped the tables in the temple and then spent days teaching there. And immediately following this parable, the elders of the community begin plotting to arrest and kill. Because Jesus' passion for the marginalized has always been threatening to the empire. We see it no less now. But that is all the more reason that we must stand together in support and defense of anyone who is marginalized, but especially right now, our immigrant neighbors. Not as a way to prove our faith, not as an act of charity or goodwill, not even solely because we are a people who care about justice, but because anytime we do this for the least of these, we do it for God. At Global Growers, one of our sites was a community garden. Small plots were available to anyone from the refugee community. A refugee from Sudan coordinated that site. She loved to give tours. And during her tours, she included the nationality or ethnic group of each gardener, proudly pointing out the places where two gardeners from traditionally opposing groups peacefully gardened next to one another. She called it her United Nations tour. To me, it felt like a tour of the kingdom of God, a kingdom where there are no more strangers, only neighbors, walking on the way together with God. Earlier we sang, Va Dios mismo en nuestro mismo caminar. The literal translation is, God goes on our same walk. God goes on our same walk. Va Dios mismo en nuestro mismo caminar. If we cannot see God in the hungry, or the thirsty, or the sick, or in prison, or in the immigrant, documented or not, we cannot see God. Because there is no other. There is no stranger. There is only us. Somos uno en Dios.
Amen.